This is Audible.
Blackstone Publishing presents Chappaquiddick, Power, Privilege, and the Ted Kennedy Cover-Up by Leo DeMore. This book is read by Peter Burkrot. Chronology. June 5, 1968. Senator Robert Kennedy is assassinated in Los Angeles. July 25th to 27th. First party for The Boiler Room is held in Hyannisport and Nantucket. July 18th to 19th, 1969. Senator Edward Kennedy's car plunges off Dyke Bridge on Chappaquiddick Island. A passenger, Mary Jo Kopechne, is killed. July 19th. At approximately 9:45 a.m., Senator Kennedy gives a statement to Edgartown Police Chief Dominic James Arena, saying he had, at 11:15 p.m. the previous evening, taken a wrong turn en route to the ferry landing on Chappaquiddick and gone off Dyke Bridge. He had escaped the accident car and returned to his hotel room. He had contacted police when he fully realized what had happened almost 10 hours later. July 22nd. Mary Jo Kopechne is buried in Plymouth, Pennsylvania. July 25th. Senator Kennedy pleads guilty to leaving the scene of an accident and is given a 2-month suspended sentence and a year probation by Edgartown District Court Judge James A. Boyle. July 25th, 1969. At 7 p.m., Senator Kennedy describes the accident in a nationally televised speech. He characterizes his conduct in not going to police sooner as indefensible and asks the voters of Massachusetts to advise him about whether to resign from the Senate. July 31st. Senator Kennedy returns to Washington to resume his Senate duties. July 31st. District Attorney Edmund S. Denise requests an inquest into the death of Mary Jo Kopechne. August 8th. Judge Boyle sets an inquest for September 3, 1969. August 27th. At a pre-inquest hearing, Judge Boyle allows the press to cover the inquest, but no lawyers will be allowed to cross-examine witnesses. September 2nd. Senator Kennedy's lawyers ask for a temporary inquest injunction from the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. September 18th. In a petition for exhumation and autopsy of Mary Jo Kopechne's body, District Attorney Denise claims blood was seen in her mouth and nose. September 24th. Mr. and Mrs. Joseph Kopechne file a petition to bar the autopsy. October 20th to 21st. Judge Bernard C. Brominski of Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, presides at a hearing on the exhumation and autopsy petition. October 30th. The Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court orders the press and the public barred from the Kopechne inquest and orders inquest documents impounded until after all possibility of prosecution against Senator Kennedy is ended. December 10th. Judge Brominski denies the exhumation and autopsy petition. December 11th. Judge Boyle sets January 5, 1970 for the Kopechne inquest. January 5th to 8th, 1970. Senator Kennedy and 26 other witnesses testify at a secret inquest at Edgartown. February 18th. Judge Boyle files his report and the transcript of inquest testimony with Edgartown Superior Court Clerk. The documents are brought to Boston Superior Courthouse for safekeeping. March 10th. Denise examines Boyle's report. March 17th. Leslie H. Leland, Edgartown grand jury foreman, requests a special session to be reconvened in order to investigate the death of Mary Jo Kopechne. March 26th. Chief Justice Joseph G. Toro of the Superior Court calls a special session of the court to convene April 6th in Edgartown for the grand jury to hear evidence in the Chappaquiddick case. April 6th to 7th. The grand jury calls four witnesses and returns no indictments. District Attorney Denise says, the case is closed, and inquest documents can now be made public. April 29th. Inquest documents are released to the public. May 14th. The results of a secret registry of motor vehicles hearing find Senator Kennedy to have been speeding and to be at serious fault in the accident. November 4th. Senator Kennedy is re-elected to the Senate. November 27th. Kennedy takes a driver's test in Plymouth, Massachusetts, and his license is reinstated. Cast of characters. Edward M. Kennedy, Senator from Massachusetts. Dominic James Arena, Police Chief, Edgartown, Massachusetts. Walter Steele, Special Prosecutor for the County of Dukes County, Martha's Vineyard. Edmund S. Denise, District Attorney for the Southern District. James H. Smith, Assistant District Attorney and former Kennedy political campaign advance man and campaign coordinator. Armand Fernandez, Assistant District Attorney. George Killen, State Police Detective Lieutenant, in charge of the Cape Cod Office of the District Attorney. Bernie Flynn, State Police Detective Lieutenant, assigned to the Cape Cod Office of the District Attorney. Dr. Donald R. Mills, Associate Medical Examiner, Edgartown. Eugene Fry, Undertaker, Vineyard Haven, Martha's Vineyard. John Farrar, Scuba Diver and Head of the Search and Rescue Division of Edgartown Volunteer Fire Department. Christopher Huck Look, Deputy Sheriff and Part-Time Special Police Officer. Russell Peachy, Manager Owner, Shiretown Inn, Edgartown. Stephen Smith, brother-in-law of Ted Kennedy, frequent campaign finance manager, and Kennedy family business manager. Herbert J. Miller, Washington attorney, former head of the criminal division, U.S. Department of Justice, under Attorney General Robert Kennedy. Edward Hanafy, attorney, chief counsel for Senator Kennedy at the Kopechne inquest. Robert Clark, Jr., attorney for Senator Kennedy, former district court judge. Richard McCarran, attorney for Senator Kennedy, Edgartown. Dan Daly, attorney retained to represent eight witnesses who attended the party at Chappaquiddick. Paul Redmond, attorney, associate of Dan Daly. Joseph Donegan, court stenographer. Andrew Tooney, former Massachusetts State Police Detective Lieutenant, employed as a private investigator for criminal lawyer F. Lee Bailey. F. Lee Bailey, criminal lawyer. James A. Boyle, District Court Judge, Edgartown, Massachusetts. Bernard C. Braminski, Presiding Judge of the Court of Common Pleas, Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Joseph and Gwen Kopechne, parents of Mary Jo Kopechne. Joseph Flanagan, attorney for the Kopechnes. Dunn Gifford, aide to Senator Kennedy. Richard Drain, press secretary to Senator Kennedy. Ross Richards, yachtsman, Hyannisport. Stanley Moore, automobile dealer and Edgartown Regatta participant. David Burke, administrative assistant to Senator Kennedy. At the party, Joseph A. Gargan, lawyer, Ted Kennedy's cousin, and co-host of the party at Chappaquiddick. Paul Markham, lawyer and former U.S. attorney for Massachusetts. Ray LaRosa, former fireman and Kennedy campaign worker. Charles Tretter, lawyer, head of the Boston Redevelopment Commission, and a Kennedy campaign aide. John Crimmins, Senator Kennedy's part-time chauffeur. The Boiler Room Girls. Mary Jo Kopechne. Rosemary Cricket Keough. Esther Newberg. Susan Tannenbaum. Nance Lyons. Mary Ellen Lyons. To James Harold Smith, class of 1947, BMC Durfee High School, Fall River, Mass. Foreword by Howie Carr. If anyone ever truly deserved a Profiles in Courage Award, it was the late Leo Damore, the author of this book. Of course, the awards are handed out by the Kennedy family, and they are all about, not courage, but political correctness. But no one can dispute the fact that Damore put himself and his career on the line to write this book, and that one way or another, he paid the ultimate price, as a suicide in 1995, at the age of 65. Senatorial Privilege, the Chappaquiddick cover-up, was a New York Times bestseller in 1988. It sold more than a million copies. Damore's volume established a previously obscure publishing house, Regnery, as a major force in the book trade. Its success also disproved what New York publishers had long believed, or perhaps just hoped, that there was no real market out there for books that spoke, really spoke, truth to liberal power. If you are just now discovering Senatorial Privilege, you may not be aware of the controversy that surrounded its initial publication. Damore seemed a most unlikely person to blow the lid off the Chappaquiddick cover-up. Born in Ontario, he was a reporter for the Cape Cod Times. His first book, in 1967, had been a standard post-JFK assassination hagiography, The Cape Cod Years of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. In the final scene of Cape Cod Years, JFK returns to Boston for the final time, in October 1963, for a major black tie fundraiser with the Democrat governors of New England. As Damore told the story, after the dinner, a Hyannis house painter named Fred Coette approached the president and was brusquely challenged by a Secret Service agent. Then JFK spots his humble Cape neighbor and yells to the agent, "Let the little guy through." Shaking Coette's hand, the president says, "Freddie, it's awfully nice to see you," and finally tells him, "I'll see you next year." That's the way all Kennedy books were written back then, even by Leo Damore. Little did Damore or anyone else know that earlier that evening, the tuxedoed president had summoned Mimi Alford, the intern he had deflowered in the White House a year earlier at the age of 19, to his suite at the Sheraton Plaza, where he ordered her to fellate his younger brother, Teddy. "You've got to be kidding, Mr. President," she recalled herself replying in her 2012 memoir. Damore got a $150,000 advance from Random House, and he spent years digging up the truth. His most important source would be Joe Gargan, Teddy's first cousin who rented the cottage that evening. Like Michael Skakel, the convicted murderer in The Next Generation, Gargan was a kinsman, but not really a Kennedy. And like Skakel, in his fury against his mistreatment by the family, Gargan would eventually spill the beans. The most explosive charge in Senatorial Privilege came from Gargan. After the accident, and the repeated rescue attempts of Mary Jo by Kennedy, Gargan, and former U.S. Attorney Paul Markham, Teddy floated an alternative story. Why couldn't Mary Jo have been driving the car? Why couldn't she have left me off and driven to the ferry herself and made a wrong turn? To which Gargan eventually responded, "You told me you were driving." When Damore handed in his manuscript to Random House, all hell broke loose. This was the home, after all, of William Faulkner, Andre Malraux, and Robert Penn Warren, not to mention Babar the Elephant. Imagine the reaction of the Random House editors as they read Damore's account of the court hearing in Pennsylvania on the exhumation of Kopechne's body, as the state medical examiner of Maryland blurted out a very inconvenient truth. "It was apparent to me from the record that she lived for a certain time underwater. So she breathed, that girl. She breathed." You just couldn't write things like that about the Kennedys back then. Seldom was heard a discouraging word about America's first family. Even the biggest names in journalism were muzzled, like James Scotty Reston, the columnist for the New York Times who owned a little paper on Martha's Vineyard. Reston was there at the police station in Edgartown that Saturday morning, as Teddy shakily wrote out the accident report. DeMore quoted Scotty in his manuscript. "I'd love to tell the story, but they won't let me." If it came down to a fight with the Kennedys, Random House couldn't win. In 1967, Jackie Kennedy had tried to stop publication of another, much more innocuous book, The Death of a President. Jackie famously told the author, "Anybody who is against me will look like a rat, unless I run off with Eddie Fisher." In retrospect, DeMore was lucky to have found any publisher willing to stand up to the wrath of the Kennedys. When it was finally published by Regnery, senatorial privilege was ignored by the critics, but DeMore's exposé was so thorough and so damning that even with no publicity, it still skyrocketed to the top of the bestseller lists. But then, Chappaquiddick was a scandal for the ages, even by Kennedy standards. Mary Jo Kopechne, for instance. Everything about her screamed Kennedy girlfriend. She wasn't wearing underwear when she died, and she was drunk. Her blood alcohol level was .09. Her first boss in Washington was Senator George Smathers of Florida, JFK's best friend in Congress, who used to travel with the future president to Havana in those pre-Castro days, where they were treated to the finest prostitutes in Cuba. Compliments of gangsters Meyer Lansky and Santo Traficante Jr. In Washington, Kopechne's landlord was Bobby Baker, the longtime bagman for, among others, Lyndon Johnson. Baker also ran a private D.C. club, which offered the services of high-priced hookers, among them Ellen Romich, a suspected East German spy who was being investigated by a Senate committee for her relationship with JFK, when she was suddenly deported in 1963. The Kennedys may not have been able to stop publication of senatorial privilege, but revenge, as they say, is a dish best served cold. And after those first few big royalty checks, nothing was ever the same for DeMore. As his wife divorced him, he fell into a deep depression and began threatening suicide. At the same time, DeMore also started research on a new book about Mary Pinchot Meyer, one of JFK's last blue-blooded girlfriends. Meyer was the drop-dead gorgeous sister-in-law of Ben Bradley, later of the Washington Post. Bradley was so close to JFK that in 1962 he was given the assignment of using his magazine, Newsweek, to spike the scandalous true story of Kennedy's first marriage to a twice-divorced Protestant socialite in Palm Beach in 1947. Meyer was another fascinating subject. During her affair with JFK, she got into drugs and had begun visiting LSD guru Dr. Timothy Leary just before the assassination. Less than a year after Dallas, she was mysteriously shot to death while jogging on a canal path in Georgetown. An obviously innocent young black man was arrested and charged, and then acquitted. The evening of her murder, Meyer's brother-in-law Bradley went to her house to retrieve her secret diary about the affair with JFK. Inside, in the dark, Bradley discovered that another intruder had gotten there first. James Jesus Angleton, the legendary CIA spook, who had his own sneaky eyes-only reasons for wanting the diary of the late president's paramour. In short, Leo DeMore had emerged from one Kennedy rabbit hole only to tumble into another, perhaps even deeper one. One of Meyer's biographers quoted DeMore as telling him, "What do you think it would do to the beatification of Kennedy if this woman said it wasn't Camelot, it was Caligula's court?" I met DeMore in 1994. On the 25th anniversary of Chappaquiddick. I was doing my radio show from the cottage on Chappaquiddick, and I booked some of the surviving principals. Only DeMore asked for money. $100. Every time I spoke to him, he seemed nervous, agitated. The day after the show, he telephoned again, begging me to send him the money ASAP, which I did. 15 months later, DeMoor was depressed and broke, about to be evicted from his rented house in Essex, Connecticut. As a visiting nurse and a constable, who was there to serve the eviction notice, looked on in horror, DeMoor pulled out a gun and shot himself in the head. Ted Kennedy died of brain cancer in 2009, at the age of 77. In his later years, it was considered bad form to even mention Chappaquiddick in polite company. Teddy himself seemed oblivious to the scandal. He named his last dog Splash. The Kennedys' official fanzine has always been the Boston Globe. Every sixth year, when he was running for re-election, the Globe would run stories about how Teddy was turning his life around, and how, in an amazing feat of self-discipline, he had totally sworn off alcohol until his birthday, February 22nd. On the day after Chappaquiddick, the Globe ran a front-page headline saying, "Senator wandered in days for hours." In 2003, the Globe perfectly summed up the mainstream media's revisionist take on Chappaquiddick. "If she had lived, Mary Jo Kopechne would be 62 years old. Through his tireless work as a legislator, Edward Kennedy would have brought comfort to her in her old age." In 2015, the Edward M. Kennedy Institute for the Senate opened in Dorchester. One of its exhibits is entitled, "The Senate Immersion Module." Immersion. You can't make this stuff up. Near the end of his life, in 2009, Teddy wrote a sorrowful letter to Pope Benedict XVI. "I have always tried to be a faithful Catholic, Your Holiness, though I have fallen short through human failings. I know that I have been an imperfect human being, but with the help of my faith I have tried to right my path." Then he added, in a somewhat incongruous attempt at penance, "I have worked to welcome the immigrant." Somehow, I don't think Teddy was referring to Leo DeMoor. Few of the principals ever talked about what happened. The prosecutor, Walter Steele, was quickly appointed to a state judgeship, another nationwide search, as we say in Massachusetts. As a judge, his most famous case involved allowing a convicted child predator to leave the state without restrictions, after which the offender moved to Montana, and then murdered and cannibalized a 7-year-old boy. When Steele reached the mandatory retirement age of 70 in 1996, the local New Bedford paper ran a story about him, without a single mention of Chappaquiddick. But Judge Steele did obliquely mention the difficulty of explaining to victims and their survivors how sometimes an obviously guilty party gets off scot-free. "It's awful hard to explain to them that you think you're doing justice." Do you think the Kopechnes would have understood what Judge Steele was getting at? As for Gargan, DeMoor paid him $15,000 for legal and editing work on senatorial privilege. Gargan eventually ended up with a hack job in Boston as chairman of a state board that essentially returned licenses to convicted drunk drivers. Ironically, despite his intimate knowledge of what happened at Chappaquiddick, Gargan became the leading proponent on the board for allowing convicted drunkards back on the road. When Republicans regained control of state government in 1991, Gargan was summarily fired. Gargan died in Virginia at age 87 in December 2017. By then, he was such a forgotten figure that when his paid death notice appeared in the Globe, no Boston reporters even noticed it for 3 weeks. According to the paid obituary, Joe was dedicated to helping those who suffer from alcohol addiction. The Boiler Room Girls you will soon be reading about have maintained omerta, silence, for almost half a century. But as DeMoor notes in Chapter 54, on the fifth anniversary of Mary Jo's death in 1974, Rosemary Cricket Kehoe did issue the following terse statement. "My friend Mary Jo just happened to be in the wrong car at the wrong time with the wrong people." In a strange way, DeMoor's life turned out like Mary Jo's. Senatorial privilege, now retitled as Chappaquiddick, Power, Privilege, and the Ted Kennedy Cover-Up, is an unforgettable book, muckraking in the best sense of the word. But for DeMoor personally, it was the wrong book at the wrong time about the wrong people, and it cost him his life. But at least we still have his book, and the truth. Introduction. Chappaquiddick has been called the most brilliant cover-up ever achieved in a nation where investigative procedures are well-developed and where the principles of equal justice prevail, at least during some of those moments where people are watching. The fascination for the most famous traffic fatality in the history of American politics remains strong today. The mysteries of the case continue to haunt Senator Edward Kennedy's career. For many, Chappaquiddick stands as the single obstacle in his path to the presidency. Those mysteries haunt not only the senator, but investigative authorities. Charges of ineptitude and lack of diligence abounded, as did insinuations that the machinery of justice crumbled beneath the power and the prestige of the Kennedy family. To his dying day, George Killen, former state police detective lieutenant and chief of a never-revealed investigation, was rankled by Chappaquiddick. Failure to bring that case to a satisfactory resolution was, he lamented, the biggest mistake of a long and distinguished police career. 2 months before his death, in 1979, Killen decried the injustice of Chappaquiddick. Senator Kennedy, he said, killed that girl the same as if he put a gun to her head and pulled the trigger. It is to George Killen that I owe the original inspiration and encouragement to undertake a reinvestigation of Chappaquiddick. To Killen's associate, State Police Detective Lieutenant Bernie Flynn, I owe a special debt for revelations about the critical part he played in the case. This book would not have been possible without the wise counsel of Joseph Gargan, Jr., and the generosity of former Assistant District Attorney Jimmy Smith. Reluctant to revive memories of a painful episode that resulted in the ruin of his own political career, former District Attorney Edmund Denise nevertheless disclosed to me his conviction. There's no question in my mind that the grand jury would have brought an indictment against Ted Kennedy for manslaughter, if I had given them the case. Former Assistant District Attorney Armand Fernandez was generous of his time and information about the part he played in the preparation of the inquest case. Peter Gay, Lance Garth, and State Police Detective Lieutenant Gordon Clarkson also provided helpful information. District Attorney Philip Rawlins and his staff made possible complete access to the official files of the case at Barnstable Courthouse. Police Chief Dominic Arena, now of Lincoln, Massachusetts, was of enormous assistance in sharing his recollections and documents about his key role in the case, as were Carmen Salvador, George Searle, and former Deputy Sheriff Christopher Look. I owe special thanks to attorneys Richard McCarran and Paul Redmond, to Edward Harrington, Frank Keating, F. Lee Bailey, and in particular, Andrew M. Tooney, for their insights into the case, and to Charles Zimmerman and Ed McGrath for expertise and technical assistance. I am indebted to court stenographer Joseph Donegan for revealing the part he played in the inquest. Cleo O'Donnell was an invaluable source of information about his brother, Kenneth. Stanley Moore and Marilyn Richards Gilbert both provided important information. Former Registrar of Motor Vehicles Richard McLaughlin and Registry Inspector Herbert Burr, and in particular, Registry Attorney Paula Golden, were very helpful in providing hitherto unavailable official records dealing with the Chappaquiddick accident under Registrar Alan Mackey's policy of open files. Richard Gill, Marianne O'Brien, James Igo, William Camera, Andrew Martin, Frank Trabucco, and Ronald Andrews helped to secure important records. Maurice G. Lauzon and Marguerite Habicht of the New Bedford Standard Times provided generous assistance, as did Harvey Ewing, Ralph Gordon, Francis Broadhurst, Don Moore, Gerald R. Kelly, Margaret Kangley, and columnist Jack Anderson. I am grateful also to Dr. John McHugh and Lieutenant James Sharkey of the Massachusetts State Police Chemistry Lab, Dr. Henry Lee, Dr. Sidney Callis, Barry Crawford, Sally Elberry, John Ryan, and John O'Connor of the New England Telephone Company. Bobby Galliani and Cynthia Field were unfailingly helpful. David Surrett, Ralph Mirano and Brian Germain assisted in the preparation of the manuscript. Sally Mary and William Woods provided important support. My wife, Dr. June King Davison, made it possible for me to undertake this work. Those others who requested their contributions be made in confidence will recognize the help they gave me in a case in which the cause of justice was frustrated. The problem of securing public officials against unwarranted legal harassment was anticipated by the Founding Fathers, who shielded members of Congress against arrest during their attendance at sessions of their respective houses in all cases except treason, felony, and breach of the peace. The Supreme Court clarified in 1907 that senatorial privilege did not, however, preclude criminal prosecution altogether. At Chappaquiddick, it did. Old Saybrook, Connecticut, March 3, 1986. For thou hast lost thy princely privilege with vile participation. Henry IV, Part 1, Act 3, Scene 2. Chapter 1. The ferry at Edgartown, on Martha's Vineyard, was not scheduled to begin operation until 7:30 a.m. on Saturday, July 19, 1969. Nevertheless, ferryman Richard Hewitt beckoned a blue Ford waiting at the dock at 7 a.m. on board the On Time, a raft-like vessel that crossed the 150-yard channel to the island of Chappaquiddick in under 4 minutes. The Ford proceeded on Chappaquiddick Road to a sweeping hairpin curve, leaving the asphalt for the dirt ruts of Dyke Road. A bumpy half-mile away was a wooden structure perched on pilings, spanning a tidal pool called Poca Pond. After negotiating the narrow bridge, the Ford discharged Robert Samuel, a high school science teacher, and 15-year-old Joseph Capovella. Burdened with fishing gear, they continued on foot along a sand track between ranks of dunes to East Beach. After an hour of fruitless casting into the surf along that deserted stretch of shoreline, the two returned to the car. Samuel was contemplating fishing off the bridge into the pond, when his attention was drawn to the glint of metal reflecting off a dark shape in the water 10 feet away, on the south side of the bridge. Looking closer through the ripples of tidewater, he discovered the shadowy outline of an automobile turned onto its roof, front end angled toward the bridge. Samuel made out the wavery numbers of a license plate on the car's inverted bumper. Samuel and Capovella headed at once for a cottage, 400 feet from the pond. Dyke House, read the printing on a mailbox beside the weathered shingles of the former hunting camp, owned by Chappaquiddick resident Anton Betancourt, and leased for the summer to Mr. and Mrs. Pierre Malm of Lebanon, Pennsylvania. A self-possessed woman of middle age, Mrs. Malm was preparing breakfast when she responded to Samuel's knock at her back door and received his report that a car was overturned in the pond. Then Samuel and Capovella returned to drop fishing lines off the bridge, oblivious to the car submerged on the other side. Mrs. Malm telephoned the Island Communications Center, maintained by the Dukes County Sheriff's Office at Martha's Vineyard Airport. At 8:20 a.m., a call from the center was logged at the two-room police station, located on the first floor of Edgartown's white clapboard town hall. Policewoman Carmen Salvador relayed the information that an automobile was underwater at Dyke Bridge on Chappaquiddick to Police Chief Dominic James Arena. She said, "Do you want to send somebody over there?" "No," Arena said, "I'll go." Arena left the station with the cruiser's blue dome light flashing. A sultry, clouding up morning presaged poor weather for the second day of the Edgartown Yacht Club's annual regatta. For 13 years, a Massachusetts state trooper assigned traffic duty and security at Boston's Logan International Airport, Arena was later attached to the Attorney General's Criminal Division, handling evidence of government corruption unearthed by the Massachusetts Crime Commission. "Because of my personality, and because I could handle people, I was running the jury room as far as witnesses were concerned, to keep them happy and keep the lawyers happy," Arena said. A newspaper story about a town meeting voting to raise the salary of its police chief to $10,000 in hopes of filling the vacant position prompted Arena to apply for the job even before he knew where that town was. The town, which he found on a map, would turn out to be Edgartown, a picturesque former whaling port, described as tidy, shipshape, and sparkling clean. In May 1967, Trooper Arena became Chief Arena, taking on a job which, in many ways, cast him as a virtual legate of the Chamber of Commerce, policing the occasional excesses of seasonal pleasure seekers, upon whom Edgartown's tourist economy depended. Pulling up to the ferry landing at the foot of Daggett Street, Arena asked Dick Hewitt, "You hear anything about an accident at the Dyke Bridge?" "Not until now," Hewitt said. Chappaquiddick looked no more than two swimming pool lengths away, the channel as close-quartered as everything else was in Edgartown, including the two-car ferry that chugged Arena across. Apart from the modest swank of the beach club's cabanas, the island was a backwater of modest cottages midst groves of scrub pine and pin oak. In 20 years, the bridge at the end of Dyke Road never had been the locale of an automobile accident. Arena parked the cruiser beside the bulkhead. He asked the young men fishing off the bridge, "Is there a car over there?" "On the other side," Samuel replied. From the slope of the humpbacked bridge, Arena saw an automobile submerged, but for the rear tires, beginning to show above the waterline. Gouges and a curbing of cap logs traced the path the automobile had taken before plunging into the pond. Arena judged the markings on the bridge's dusty planks. Weren't really what you could call skid marks. They were more like scuff marks that probably were brought about by tires going sideways, sliding more than skidding across something. Arena observed a woman approach the pond. Mrs. Malm was taking a look at the accident herself. She'd heard a car pass the house, going faster than usual, around midnight the previous evening, but nothing else. Arena was amazed she had not heard the car hit the water. He asked if her husband had a bathing suit he could borrow. He followed her into Dyke House to change into plaid boxer trunks that, to his surprise, for he was 6'4" tall and weighed 230 pounds, fit him perfectly. Arena walked to the pond and waded in until the banking dropped off. He swam towards the car, encountering a turbulence of current. He dived underwater. He caught only a blurred glimpse of the automobile before he was dragged away by the inexorable force of an outgoing tide he estimated was running to a depth of 6 feet because he could touch bottom. Arena had a presentiment of dread. Whoever had driven off the bridge might not have escaped from the crushed and upended position in which the vehicle had landed, and could still be trapped inside. Any survivor would have reported the accident by now, and there had been no report on the answering machine that recorded calls after the police station closed, or on the log Arena checked when he arrived at the station that morning. Arena radioed the communications center from the cruiser. He told the on-duty dispatcher to have the police station send an officer and the fire department scuba diver to the scene. Arena asked the two small boys standing near the bridge if they knew where there was a face mask he could use. One of the boys said, "I think there's one in the boat." He ran to a flat-bottomed punt beached on shore and tossed a mask to Arena. Arena dived into the pond again. The current repeatedly sent him out of control. He let himself be swept to the bridge pilings where he caught his breath, then swam back to the car. Hoisting himself onto the undercarriage, he found seating space beside the gas tank, there to await the arrival of help. Arena had cut the inside of his big toe on some metal edge of the car, but he was too distracted to care whether the wound was bleeding. Word of the accident was bringing spectators to the pond's edge, despite a light rain that had started to fall. After catching 5 bluefish, Samuel and Capovella were packing up their gear, preparing to leave. Arena's activities in Poca Pond had scared away the fish. At 8:45 a.m., Arena recognized the blinking red bulb atop Edgartown Fire Chief Anton Silva's station wagon, bumping down the Dyke Road, followed by Anton Betancourt's blue jeepster. With Silva was volunteer fireman Lawrence Mercier, the proprietor of an Edgartown grocery store, and police officer Robert Bregeur. A special, hired for the summer, Bregeur was a teacher of business subjects at Natick High School. Arena told him, See if you can get a registry listing for this license. And called out plate number L78207 from the submerged car's inverted front bumper. Brugeur radioed the communications center to check the Polk Directory of Massachusetts registrations to find out who owned the car in the pond. Then he drove the police cruiser to the beach side of the bridge. Arena watched John Ferrara adjust an oxygen tank across his back. Captain of the Search and Rescue Division of Edgartown's Volunteer Fire Department, Farrar had received a call at 8:25 a.m. to proceed at once to Dyke Bridge on Chappaquiddick. Farrar left the turf and tackle shop he managed in Edgartown for the fire station, where diving gear was maintained in immediate readiness. He was joined by Antoine Betancourt, a sprightly 70-year-old retired ferrymaster who drove him to the dock. Fire Chief Silva was waiting on the Chappaquiddick landing to help transfer rescue equipment to his cruiser. Farrar changed into a full diving suit en route to the accident scene, arriving there at 8:45 a.m. Arena's attention was diverted by Brugeur calling out information he'd received over the cruiser's radio. License plate L78207 had been issued to Edward M. Kennedy, room 2400, JFK Building, Government Center, Boston. My God, another tragedy, Arena thought. His concern for the accident tuned to a higher frequency of alarm. But he had no time to ponder the stunning news that it was Ted Kennedy's car he was sitting on. Farrar was swimming toward him, holding a safety line. He gave Arena one end of the rope, put an oxygen tube in his mouth, and dove underwater. When his mask cleared, Farrar saw in the wash of watery light he likened to the sfumato effect of a Rembrandt painting. An Oldsmobile sedan balanced on the brow of its windshield, tipped forward from the weight of the engine so that its rear end was tilted toward the surface. The car was facing the opposite direction it had been traveling before plunging off the bridge. Only speed could account for such aerial maneuvers, Farrar said later. The car must have been going at a pretty good clip to land almost in the middle of the channel. Farrar peered through the driver's side open window. It took 20 seconds for his eyes to grow accustomed to the gloom inside the car. The front seat was empty. Farrar made his way to the back of the car, fighting a current he estimated was running 4 knots, hard to swim against for any length of time. Through the top right-hand corner of the rear window, Farrar saw 2 motionless feet clad in sandals. So long as there was a possibility the occupant might be alive and breathing, he had to hurry and expand the air in the automobile, and bring a resuscitator if necessary. Farrar moved quickly to the right side of the car. The rear passenger window had been blown out. Shards of glass formed a ragged edge along the frame. Farrar thrust himself through the portal inside the car to his waist. Looking up, he found the body of a young woman. Her head was cocked back, her face pressed into the footwell. Both hands gripped the front edge of the back seat to hold herself in conformity with its upholstered contours. It was not a position assumed by a person knocked unconscious by the impact of a crash, Farrar said. If she had been dead or unconscious, she would have been prone, sinking to the bottom or floating on top. She definitely was holding herself in a position to avail herself of the last remaining air that had to be trapped in the car. Farrar took hold of the right thigh. As soon as he touched the body, he knew the woman was dead. The flesh under his grasp was hard as wood. Instead of life-saving, I was evidence-gathering, Farrar realized. Because I was the only person who would be able to observe this situation, it behooved me to think about what I saw underwater to be able to report it. Farrar rotated the body inside the car, a maneuver complicated by the victim's hunched posture and outstretched arms, made inflexible by rigor mortis. The body was about 1/4 positively buoyant, Farrar observed. There was still a little air left in her. Farrar drew the body through the window head first. A gold chain clasped about the waist came undone and slipped off. He struggled to maintain his position beside the car against the current. Concerned he might lose the body when he swam to the surface, Farrar bound the safety line about the woman's neck. He tugged on the rope to signal he was coming up. Clasping the body over his head, Farrar pushed off. He broke the surface as Arena was gathering in the last feet of slack line. Burrow noted with satisfaction that the police chief's assistance was not required to bring the body up. The difficult recovery had taken him 10 minutes. The current took Farrar downstream toward the bridge. Holding the body in a cross-chest carry, he swam to the rear of Kennedy's car. For the first time in the several years he had known Arena as a very placid individual, very calm and collected, Farrar observed him to be excited and emotionally wrought up. Arena had a quaver in his voice when he said, "My God, it's a body. Do you recognize her? Is it one of the Kennedy clan?" "I haven't had a chance to see if I recognize her or not," Farrar said. He turned the body over in the water. Arena examined the face for a Kennedy family likeness. Farrar observed a great look of relief on Arena's face before he said, "Thank God, no, I don't recognize her. It isn't one of the clan." Farrar undid the safety line. The victim's blonde hair was tangled in the half-hitch knots he tied. Farrar helped draw the body out of the water onto Arena's lap. Holding the corpse in his arms, Arena scrutinized the pale, lightly freckled face, rigid in death. The mouth was open, teeth gritted in a death grimace. Pale eyes stared through partially closed lids. She wore a long-sleeve white blouse and navy blue slacks. There was a friendship ring on her left hand. 2 gold bracelets dangled from her wrist. "She appeared normal in the sense that there were no injuries that I could see," Arena said later. "If she hadn't been wringing wet, it was as if she was about to go to work or to a party, because everything was in place. Everything was buttoned right up." Fireman Lawrence Mercier called from the bulkhead, "Do you want the boat?" before pushing it out into the pond on a rope. Arena and Farrar placed the body across slat seats. The boat was drawn to shore. Passed hand over hand to the bridge, the body was placed on a stretcher in the back of the police cruiser. Arena ordered Brogier to summon the medical examiner and undertaker, and have a tow truck sent to the scene. As required in all fatal automobile accidents, the Registry of Motor Vehicles had to be notified, too. Arena said, "And see if you can find out where Ted Kennedy is, and get him down here." Arena asked Tony Betancourt to drive to the landing to wait for the medical examiner to come off the ferry. Farrar dove underwater to retrieve the chain belt that had detached from the body. He checked the rest of the car. On the interior roof near the front passenger seat, he found a workman's lunch pail lacquered with a decoupage of flowers and fashioned into a handbag. When Arena opened it, water gushed forth, a spillage of cosmetics and articles of grooming. A wallet contained a Virginia's driver's license and a pass for the United States Senate, identifying Rosemary Keough of Washington, D.C. There were 2 keys for room 56 at the Katama Shores Motor Inn of Edgartown. Arena radioed the communications center to confirm that Keough was registered at the motel. Minutes later, he received confirmation. She was one of 6 young women who had occupied 3 rooms there since Thursday. None of the beds had been slept in the previous night. Arena told Farrar to check downstream. "It's possible there were other people in the car. They might be in the pond someplace." He was walking off the bridge when the Depot Corner Garage tow truck pulled up with John Album at the wheel. The truck had emblazoned on its side panel, "You wreck 'em, we fetch 'em." Arena didn't want Album to remove the car from Poca Pond until registry inspectors arrived. He said, "They don't like it when an accident scene is disturbed before they can do their investigation." Concerned about the hazard presented by a growing crowd of spectators at the pond's edge, Arena changed his mind. The registry office in Oak Bluffs was closed on Saturday. "I don't think we can get a hold of the registry today. You better get the car out as soon as you can and hold it at the garage," Arena added. "That's Ted Kennedy's car down there in the water." "Gee, I just saw him at the ferry landing on the Chappie side," Album said. "Oh, God, I better get a hold of him," Arena said. Arena was walking down Dyke Road when a Pontiac station wagon pulled up. "Jim, can I help you?" Christopher Huck Look said. Look was a deputy sheriff and a special duty police officer. A call to his cottage on Chappaquiddick suggested Look might be needed at the accident scene.
You probably can help keep traffic away from the bridge, Arena said. There's a car overturned in the pond. We're trying to find out if there's anyone else in it.
I saw a car last night, Look said. I hope to God that isn't the same one.
Arena was too preoccupied to continue the conversation and walked off. Look got out of his car and watched the chief head for Dyke House. Arena was going to call the police station to send somebody down to the ferry to locate Ted Kennedy.
Chapter 2
Arriving at the landing on this errand at 9:30 a.m., Anton Betancourt addressed Dick Hewitt on the dock on time.
Do you know about the accident? It's Ted Kennedy's car and there's a dead girl in it.
Hewitt nodded in the direction of a weathered ferry house at the landing.
Well, he's standing right over there with two men.
Betancourt confronted Ted Kennedy.
Senator, do you know there's a girl found dead in your car?
He said. Do you need a ride down to the bridge?
No, Kennedy said. I'm going on over to town.
Betancourt watched the on-time leave the landing for the crossing to Edgartown. Minutes later, the ferry was back. Hewitt made several round trips during the next 15 minutes. He observed Ted Kennedy and two other men milling around the ferry house. Hewitt wondered if the senator knew about the accident.
The same idea had occurred to Steve Ewing, the ferry's 16-year-old deckhand.
We realized by this time the senator's car was involved in the accident, he said. We thought he was waiting there for news.
Kennedy had boarded the ferry shortly after Ewing reported for work at 9 a.m. The senator greeted the boy with a cheerful hi when Ewing collected three 15-cent fares. After the boat ride to Chappaquiddick, the three men had gathered at the ferry house, which was furnished with benches and a public telephone. Hewitt and Ewing walked off the docked ferry. At their approach, Kennedy edged toward a row of parked cars. He was within hearing distance when Hewitt called out,
Senator, are you aware of the accident?
A tall man wearing glasses answered, Yes, we just heard about it. Hewitt and Ewing returned to the ferry. Kennedy and the tall man wearing glasses followed. This time, Ewing noted, Kennedy looked worried.
Steve Ewing's father was standing at the Edgartown dock. Vineyard bureau chief for the New Bedford Standard Times, Harvey Ewing had heard about an accident at Chappaquiddick involving a member of Ted Kennedy's regatta party and had gone to the landing to cover the story. It was 9:50 a.m. when he spotted Ted Kennedy on board the On Time bound for Edgartown. Ewing made ready to take a photograph, but before the ferry docked, Kennedy jumped off and was striding up Daggett Street at such a brisk pace, he walked out of focus.
That's why the picture isn't very good, Ewing apologized later, because I didn't get him full face coming at me off the ferry. I got him sideways.
Ewing wasn't sure why he had taken the picture.
I figured if someone in his party had been in an accident, it was a normal reaction for him to be over there checking things out, that he'd be concerned, he said. Kennedy looked in fine shape, smartly turned out in light blue pants, white polo shirt, and canvas deck shoes.
Ewing went to a payphone at the dock to call Bob Hyde, his summer assistant. Ewing wanted Hyde at the accident scene while he maintained telephone contact with his paper in New Bedford. Ewing told him, All I know is a car went into the drink, and whoever was in it is involved with the Kennedy party. They think there's more than one person in the car. Ewing was joined at the landing by Colbert Smith, assistant editor of the Vineyard Gazette. Boarding the ferry was undertaker Eugene Fry, with the Buick station wagon he used as a hearse, his assistant David Guy, and an associate medical examiner, Dr. Donald Mills. Mills had been alerted by his receptionist, Mrs. Thomas Teller.
Don't be surprised if you get a call to go to Chappie. I hear there's been a fatal of some kind over there.
Mills received the call because it was medical examiner Dr. Robert Nevin's day off. He left his office and drove to the ferry landing. Fry invited him into the hearse for the journey to Chappaquiddick. Mills observed a dozen bystanders on Dyke Bridge. Wearing a bathing suit and a wet T-shirt, Police Chief Arena was entering Dyke House. Arena used Mrs. Malm's phone to call the police station. He told Carmen Salvador to send someone down to the ferry to find Ted Kennedy.
He's right here, Chief, Salvador said, and he wants to talk to you.
I'm afraid, Senator, I have some bad news, Arena said. There's been another tragedy. Your car was in an accident over here, and the young lady is dead.
I know, Kennedy said.
Can you tell me, was there anybody else in the car?
Yes, Kennedy said.
Are they in the water?
No, Kennedy said.
Can I talk to you? Could I see you?
Do you want to come over here? Arena said. Or do you want me to go over there?
I prefer for you to come over here, Kennedy said.
Not bothering to change clothes, Arena rushed out of Dyke House to find a ride to Edgartown. He asked Huck Look for a lift to the ferry. Look didn't have his car there. Look approached Dr. Edward Self, standing near the bulkhead. A prominent New York surgeon and president of the Chappaquiddick Association of Island Residents, Self agreed to chauffeur Arena to the landing. Arena was just getting into Self's Land Rover when Bregeur reported Huck Look had seen the accident car, or one just like it, up at the corner around 12:45 a.m. the previous evening. Arena didn't give much notice to the report. Look was a year-rounder with a variety of part-time vocations, including off-season heating oil dealer. Arena would have plenty of time to question Look later. Right now, Arena was more concerned about his forthcoming interview with Senator Ted Kennedy at the police station. Police officer Roy Meekins was waiting at the Edgartown landing, as he had been instructed when Bregeur radioed to have a cruiser meet Arena there. Then Bregeur greeted Dr. Mills. He explained that a young woman had been recovered from the overturned car in the pond. Mills wanted the body brought to the front of the cruiser so as not to expose it to spectators standing on the bridge. The stretcher was placed near the cruiser's front grill. Mills uncovered a blanket to find a well-developed, well-nourished, very attractive young woman in complete rigor mortis. Her arms were stretched outward from her shoulders as if to ward off an assault. Hands were frozen in a semi-claw. There was a fine white froth about the nose and mouth, flecked with a barely visible cobweb of blood that went directly to a capillary area on the left nostril. It was, in Dr. Mills' opinion, the characteristic foam that goes with a drowning case. Mills ran his fingers through the wet hair for evidence of skull fracture, then the throat and neck. He unbuttoned the blouse to expose a lacy blue brassiere. He placed a stethoscope over the heart. There was no sound. He felt the rib cage, then tapped the chest, repeating the procedure with varying degrees of pressure. Each time, water welled up from inside the lungs, creating a splashing sound. The lightest pressure produced water from the mouth and nose. Mills did not remove the brassiere to examine the breasts for injury. He slid the slacks over her hips, exposing her enough to make an adequate examination, he explained. I couldn't have removed her clothes without cutting them off because of rigor mortis. Fry closely followed Mills' examination. As a mortician, I more or less kept my eyes open, he said. Water seeped from the nose and mouth when the body was turned onto its left side, Fry observed. That probably came from her stomach. No, I'm pressing her chest, Mills said. That's water from her lungs. Mills passed his hands over the back and abdomen. He found no evidence of trauma of any kind. He diagnosed an obvious and clear case of drowning. After all, he said later, the girl was found in a submerged automobile. Mills overheard several bystanders speculating that the accident victim was a secretary employed by the Kennedy family. Mills ordered Fry to remove the body to his funeral home, but to hold off embalming. In view of certain non-medical factors and personalities, he had heard only as a rumor. Mills wanted to consult the district attorney's office about a possible autopsy, he said. If there's any Kennedy mix-up in this, it's more than I want to handle alone. Mills rode back to Edgartown in Fry's hearse. Although he viewed the death of this lovely young person as a shame, he was more concerned at that moment about the patient in labor he had sent to Martha's Vineyard Hospital in Oak Bluffs, 7 miles away. The hospital's emergency room had monitored transmissions to and from the communications center,
concerning a fatal accident on Chappaquiddick involving Senator Ted Kennedy's automobile. The information was reported by on-duty nurse Barbara Ferry to her husband at 9:30 a.m. Richard Ferry, an employee of the Woods Hole, Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket Steamship Authority that provides